Hello, and welcome to Sekahan Global Reactions. Today, a blockade in the Red Sea and the quiet end of an era when the safety of the sea came for free. First, what happened in one breath? On July 20th, 2026, Yemen's Houthi movement declared a maritime blockade against shipping bound for Saudi Arabia. 2 days later, a Saudi product tanker was hit by a missile in the southern Red Sea. Ships already sailing the Red Sea began changing course, and some turned around entirely. When the Strait of Hormuz seized up earlier this year, analysts said the same thing could happen at other choke points. This time, it actually did. So this is not a surprise. It is a predicted escalation, a step up a ladder that was described before anyone climbed it. There are three questions worth holding on to. 1. How exactly did that predicted chain move up a rung? 2. Why is it insurance and not warships that closes a sea? 3. What kind of world are we entering? Let's take them in order. Let's look at what the blockade actually covers. It is not aimed at every ship. The declared targets are vessels arriving at or departing from Saudi Arabia's ports on the Red Sea coast. A senior Houthi official said the passage of non-Saudi ships would not be obstructed. The immediate trigger is said to be the truce between Saudi Arabia and the Houthis, which broke down in July. The Houthis framed the blockade as retaliation for a Saudi blockade of Yemen's ports and airports, which Saudi Arabia denies is happening. The declaration did not stay a matter of words. On July 22nd, the Ancilia, a Saudi oil product tanker, was struck by a missile in the southern Red Sea. The Houthis claimed responsibility. The same day, 5 ships in the Red Sea changed course, and 3 carrying Saudi crude for China and India turned back the way they had come. The European Union's naval mission advised ships linked to Israel, the United States, or Saudi Arabia to avoid the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Washington responded as well. President Trump said Iran would be held responsible for the Houthi attacks. But the real focus has shifted away from military exchanges toward how far this blockade changes the routing decisions of shipping companies. How thin a blockade aimed only at Saudi cargo can actually make the route is something the coming numbers will tell us. Here are 3 pieces of context. First, how Hormuz seized up and where the oil escaped to. When war between Iran and the United States and Israel began at the end of February, the Strait of Hormuz, long the main artery for crude oil, rapidly stopped functioning. By March, war risk insurance premiums for ships had risen to more than 10 times peacetime levels in some cases, and commercial traffic thinned out well before the waterway was physically blocked. To move crude without passing through the strait, Saudi Arabia used its east-west pipeline to send oil to the port of Yanbu on the Red Sea coast. But the volumes do not match. Roughly 20 million barrels a day were flowing through Hormuz, while the spare pipeline capacity available for rerouting is about 2.6 million barrels a day. The Red Sea was an alternative route, but never a route that could carry the same amount. Second, who the Houthis are. The Houthis are an armed movement that controls northwestern Yemen, including the capital Sana'a and most of the country's populated areas. They receive weapons and funding from Iran, but they also make their own decisions, and they are not regarded as an organization fully under Iranian command. And this is not the first time they have stopped ships at sea. From November 2023, they attacked merchant vessels for months, and oil passing through the Red Sea choke point fell from about 9.3 million barrels a day to about 4.1 million, close to a halving. Third, the stage itself. Bab el-Mandeb is a narrow strait at the southern exit of the Red Sea, connecting it to the Gulf of Aden. Together with the Suez Canal, this strait has formed the spine of the shortest sea route between Europe and Asia. If it becomes unusable, ships are forced into the long haul around the Cape of Good Hope, at the southern tip of Africa. And the Red Sea route, the escape hatch from Hormuz, cannot reach the open ocean without passing through this same strait. Now, how Reddit reacted. On boards like r/oil, where oil investors gather, the debate was mostly about whether a blockade is actually feasible. One comment captured the dominant view. People talk as if they only ever threatened it. That's wrong. They actually blockaded, and it worked. Traffic still hasn't returned to what it was back then. On the question of whether a blockade is possible, the voices granting them the capability were in the majority. One analysis: they have tunnels dug into the hills overlooking the strait, and they use mobile launchers, so they probably can. Another pointed out that tankers are not exactly known for carrying systems that shoot down missiles and drones. On the other side, skeptics noted that the Houthis have announced a blockade about 3 times before, and it never materialized. The reply to that was pointed. This time they named the conditions under which they would do it. And when the other side is talking, you should listen. And three observations pointed straight at what we want to analyze next. On insurance, if a $100 million tanker is carrying hundreds of millions in oil, no insurer wants to cover it through water with a clear stated threat. On the shape of it, the supply was pushed onto the Red Sea route, and now that escape route is the one being hit. One commenter simply called it a trap. And on the technology. Cheap drones are ending the era when overwhelming firepower decided things. It's a strange way to put it, one comment said, but war is rapidly being democratized. Now for the core of this video. What happened here moved up a 3-rung ladder, one rung at a time. The first rung was a long-standing concern that if war came, Iran might close the Strait of Hormuz. The second rung was that concern coming true in March. Without any full blockade, insurance and private judgment were enough to make the strait stop working. The third rung is this extension. The Red Sea, the escape route from Hormuz, has now been folded into the same war as a means of pressure. Every rung was described in advance at the previous rung. There is no surprise here at all. That, we think, is exactly what makes it heavy. So what actually changed on that third rung? Weaponizing a strait is no longer something only states can do. How far Iran and the Houthis are coordinating cannot be seen from outside. Their interests overlap, but the Houthis are not simply taking orders. Either way, the result is the same. A group nowhere near a great power in military terms demonstrated, in practice, that it can stop traffic through a strait. The ability to threaten a choke point is starting to work as one of the few vetoes a weaker actor holds against far stronger states. In other words, blockade has become a real option against the world's straits, not a theoretical one. But that power only works by putting merchant ships and their crews in danger. The method itself cannot be justified by any political framing. On to the second question. Why is it insurance, and not warships, that closes the sea? No navy has to block the water. If underwriters stop writing cover, the sea stops. That is precisely what happened at Hormuz. What is new this time is that the risks of two routes, Hormuz and the Red Sea, are being priced into premiums and routing decisions at the same time. Ship owners and insurers do not judge individual straits. They add up the risk of the whole voyage. So the very premise of diversion, it's dangerous here, so send it that way, starts to wobble. The alternative route stops functioning as an alternative. In the tanker war of the 1980s, global oil supply never stopped completely either. The difference now is that the place the burden escapes to is being threatened at the same time. There is one more design feature worth noting. This is not a total closure. It is closer to a checkpoint that decides which ships may pass. But that sorting cannot work the way the declaration says. In modern shipping, flag, owner, operator, cargo, and port history are tangled across borders, so the line around Saudi linked is hard to draw from outside. In fact, the European Naval Mission advised ships that had called at Saudi ports to keep their position broadcasts to a minimum. In a sea where ships pass while hiding where they are, the premise of a safe commercial route is already gone. Even so, this design, a route where traffic is sorted, maybe a preview of what the sea becomes. A ship's safety decided not by international law but by its charterer, its ports of call, and its political relationships. That points toward a sea splitting into lanes with different levels of safety, depending on your alignment. So this tactic spread around the world? There is certainly a structure that makes it tempting to copy. To shoot down drones costing tens of thousands of dollars, defenders burn interceptor missiles costing millions of dollars each. And a navy can only protect the ships it escorts. It cannot protect the decisions of insurers. Stop 99 attacks out of 100, and the one ship that is hit still sends premiums jumping and thins the route out. That said, the same tactic does not work in every strait. It needs several conditions at once: a narrow passage, few real alternatives, a vacuum of coastal governance, terrain that hides the launchers, and political backing. Very few places in the world have all of them. The Strait of Malacca, for example, carries even more traffic, but the governance capacity of its coastal states and its geography are nothing like the Red Sea. The third question, what kind of world are we entering? In a phrase, one where the sea is no longer free. When a sea route closes, it does not mean the oil stops arriving altogether. What happens is that costs swell. From the Saudi port of Yanbu to Taiwan, the voyage takes about 19 days through the strait and about 48 days if diverted, with fuel costs roughly doubling by one estimate. And the Red Sea diversions of 2024 are estimated to have raised global container shipping demand by 12% just to move the same volume of goods. Until now, global logistics could treat the safety of the sea as a free public good and compete purely on efficiency. With that premise gone, the world pays continuously for slack, stockpiles, diversified suppliers, alternative routes, in one word, redundancy. In calm times, that slack looks like nothing but cost. Only in a crisis does it work as insurance. To see what this costs a single country, Japan is a clear example, and the question it faces is not only Japan's. More than 95% of Japan's crude oil comes from the Middle East, and nearly all of it passes through the Strait of Hormuz. Its liquefied natural gas, by contrast, has been diversified over years, and its exposure to Hormuz is only around 6%. Same energy sector, completely different resilience. And the effect is not hypothetical. Right after the blockade was declared, a tanker carrying naphtha for Japan switched to a longer route rather than sail down the Red Sea. Japan holds more than 200 days of oil reserves and has spread its gas suppliers. Those choices only pay off in a crisis like this one. Every importing country can run the same arithmetic on itself, and most have not. Three things to watch from here. First, how far a blockade aimed only at Saudi cargo actually thins out the route and the fleet deployments. Second, who holds the initiative? Is this a blockade that a deal with Saudi Arabia can lift, or one that lasts until the war between the United States and Iran ends? The Houthis' aims have several layers: retaliation against Saudi Arabia, a bargaining chip, and interests that overlap with Iran's. Which layer is leading changes how this ends. Third, whether this design, where a ship's safety is decided by political relationships, spreads to other seas. Time to wrap up. This blockade is not a story about the world's seas all closing at once. What changed is that whether a route is usable now depends not only on geography and international law, but on political relationships and private risk calculations. The era when seas anyone could sail were a free assumption is quietly ending. The safety of the sea used to be given to us. Now it is something that has to be designed. Finally, the thing to take away from this: stockpiles, diversified sourcing, alternative routes. The question of what to hold spare in calm times is reaching companies, governments, and households too, through electricity bills and fuel prices. And close behind it comes a harder question: who is going to pay for holding it? When the next strait gets named, whether that question has been answered in advance is what will decide how deep the crisis goes. Watch this together with our video on the Hormuz toll, and the shift in the rules and the structure of the sea comes into view as one continuous story. The full analysis and more reactions are on our blog, Secahan. The link is in the description. Thanks for watching.